is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Hefta is a controversial figure, no doubt about it. But he is also a unifying figure for the Libyan National Army. And the Libyan National Army, in turn, guarantees currently stability in the east and vitally also in the south.
That's Wolfgang Porstai, a former envoy to Libya, talking about prospects for a negotiated peace in Libya. Details coming up also. The transitional government of Mali has released a dozen political and military figures arrested during the coup. And UNICEF says the situation for children in the eastern DRC is getting worse. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. diplomats are talking with Turkish and Egyptian officials about how to de-escalate the military situation in Libya so that the ongoing political dialogue can make progress towards peace. The Berlin 2 conference on Monday called on all the regional and international backers of the two warring sides in Libya to refrain from sending arms to or reinforcements to the country. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi discussed with Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian attaché to Libya, about the effort to bolster the dialogue.
No, for the time being, no. Their statements are just lip services. They simply don't trust each other. But a stable ceasefire could change things. Actually, I would say, keeping in particular the difficult COVID-19 situation, also for Turkey, or especially for Turkey, but also for the Emirates in mind, such a sustainable, stable ceasefire could make Libya cheaper for all of them. And this could be an incentive. On the other side, we need to be aware that Turkey and Russia need their military engagement, as their influence on the ground rests mostly with their military involvement.
So in case third red line is violated, would Egypt intervene?
I'm sure. President al-Sisi simply cannot afford to leave this case to Turkey, cannot afford that the Operation Volcano would advance to the Egyptian border. This would be absolutely a deadly threat for Egypt. And as al-Sisi is aware of this, he would certainly intervene. And the Egyptian military, especially the Egyptian Air Force, has the capability to attack, to strike, to destroy the few systems which are key for an advance of the Operation Volcano to the Egyptian border, namely the air defense systems, namely the long-range artillery and electronic warfare systems.
Could the leader of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, who seems to be sidelined in political talks, spoil any agreements that could be reached in the Libyan dialogue hosted by Morocco?
Absolutely, he could, especially when it comes to concrete negotiations about the ceasefire, because his signature will be needed. He still enjoys the loyalty of most of the LNA forces and their commanders. But let me stress, I'm not sure that the resignation of Marshal Haftar right now would be really desirable for those who do not believe in a military solution for Libya. Haftar is a controversial figure, no doubt about it. But he is also a unifying figure for the Libyan National Army. And the Libyan National Army, in turn, guarantees currently stability in the east and vitally also in the south. There is no clear number two who could take over. And this means if Haftar would resign now, the LNA could very well split up and break up. And this could mean, or would probably mean, that we could see some more kind of Tripoli-style militia infighting also in Cyrenaica and in Fezzan. If there is a new presidential council, and Haftar won't be on the presidential council, I don't see any option or whatever idea that he could be one of the president nominated by the East. If there is this presidential council legitimated by the House of Representatives and the SSC, continue with the political process. If there is a stable ceasefire, his necessity is limited. Egypt discussing and engaging mainly with Aguila Saleh makes most sense. For the time being, Saleh, he is the elected president of the House of Representatives, and he is the political guy. And if there is someone else from the East sitting in the presidential council, also the role of Aguila Saleh will not be that important in the future. For the time being, those two guys are needed, but their role could be more or less gone within 6 months. If there is a stable military situation, and if there is such a peacekeeping force there, Haftar could not escalate again. And also for the others, as I said, I don't foresee a situation where the Misrata would attack the Germans. there is a risk that the jihadists in the south, the Islamic State and others, and maybe also some guys, Islamists from the east, could attack them. But okay, military business is dangerous.
But Egypt is insisting to unite the military in Libya, and they are envisioning Haftar to be the commander-in-chief.
I think that for the time being, Egypt considers Haftar also as someone who is required right now to keep the situation down or calm. I don't think that they are counting on him in the long term.
That was Wolfgang Pashtai, former Austrian attaché to Libya, talking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Respecting the demands of international powers, including the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, the transitional government of Mali has released a dozen political and military figures arrested during the coup. According to Reuters News Service, Colonel Assimi Goïta, who led the coup and serves as vice president in the transitional government in charge of security and defense, yesterday announced that political and military figures arrested in August 18th have been set free. Among those released are Mali's former prime minister, Boubou Cisse, former head of the National Assembly, Moussa Tembin, and eight generals. The senior figures had been held since the ouster of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The coup alarmed Mali's foreign partners, who feared it would further destabilize Mali and undermine a joint fight against Islamist militants in the wider Sahel region. Burundi's government wants hundreds of thousands of its citizens who left the country because of violence to return home. But human rights groups warn the conditions to ensure the refugees' safety aren't yet in place. The Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement to end a civil war between Hutu and Tutsi militias was signed in Tanzania more than two decades ago. But as Darren Taylor reports, the violence has continued and many thousands of lives have since been lost.
Excellency, Monsieur Volkan.
Your Excellency, Mr. Volkan Bozkir.
President Evariste Ndayishimiye addressed the United Nations General Assembly recently.
I am pleased to inform you that the situation in Burundi is stable, calm, and entirely under control across the whole territory.
That was the UN translator for Ndayishimiye. Yet, in the weeks leading up to his speech and after it, rebels launched several attacks on government troops, and Burundi human rights activist Marie-Louise Barikako says government supporters, police and soldiers continue to attack those they perceive to be an enemy of the state.
Burundi needs to be a country where people can move freely, where people can sleep and know that they will wake up tomorrow, where people can engage in productive activities, knowing very well that security is ensured, that they are safe.
Ndayishimiye says Burundi is now so safe that people who left because of violence in the past are coming back home. Again, through the translator.
We welcome the mass and voluntary return of Burundian refugees who had fled the country following the sorry episodes which have left a sad mark on Burundi's history. From the 1st of August 2017 until the 31st of August 2020, 92,285 refugees were voluntarily repatriated to Burundi.
But Barikako says only some of the refugees returned willingly. She's concerned that some African governments are now using the president's UN speech as justification for expelling her compatriots.
Today, what is happening is a very, very serious problem with the refugees in Tanzania who are being forced to go back home because apparently there is no more any problem in Burundi. And yet, we still have problems in Burundi. We still have people killed in Burundi. We still have human rights violations in Burundi.
According to the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi, state forces have, over the past few months, executed, arrested, detained, tortured, and ill-treated government opponents and critics. Ndayishimiye denies this, and through the translator, says it's time for the UN to remove Burundi from its list of human rights concerns.
Burundi is included on the Security Council agenda completely arbitrarily for political reasons and egotistical interests of some powers. This has nothing to do with the well-being of the Burundian people. This inclusion on the agenda is a factor that destabilizes our country rather than fostering peace and tranquility.
The president says the East African Community of States should be the primary helpers of Burundi, not powers of the global north. But Barikako and other activists don't trust the regional organization. She says when violence erupted in Burundi in 2015, after then-president Pierre Nkurunziza announced he'd run for a third term, the country's neighbors pledged to facilitate talks between the opposing parties.
Unfortunately, this dialogue never happened. Why? Because of lack of collaboration of the Burundi government of that time, and also because of lack of commitment of the leaders of East African community.
So says Barikako, it's disingenuous of the same East African leaders who've done little to secure lasting peace in Burundi to now agree with Ndayishimiye that it's time for refugees to go back home. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Nigeria's Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala and South Korea's Yoo Myung-hee today made it through to next month's runoff of the campaign to pick the World Trade Organization's new Director General. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala has twice served as Nigeria's finance minister and its first woman foreign minister. She also served as a development economist for more than 20 years at the World Bank, rising to managing director. If selected, she would be the WTO's first director general from Africa. Her rival for the WTO post is South Korean trade minister Yoo Myung-hee. She began her career in 1995 working in the trade ministry and rose to become known as one of the country's top trade negotiators. No matter who wins in the final vote in November, the WTO will have its first female chief since its creation in 1995. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. diplomats are talking with Turkish and Egyptian officials about how to de-escalate the military situation in Libya. The transitional government in Mali has released a dozen political and military figures arrested during the coup. And Burundi's government wants hundreds of thousands of its citizens who left the country because of violence to return home. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says it is deeply concerned about thousands of children at risk amid unrelenting violence in Ituri province of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has more.
The organization says children continue to suffer grievously because of violence and chaos unleashed by long-running conflict in Ituri province. The violence intensified at the beginning of the year, and since then conditions for thousands of children in Ituri have deteriorated further. Kiara Frixona is a UNICEF spokesperson in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Frixona says Ituri province has seen rising fighting over control of resources and inter-community tensions. She says since this year, violence has intensified around the areas of Dugu, Mahagi, and Iremu. Frixona says armed groups continue to kill and rape civilians, including children, and to force many to flee their homes.
It is estimated that more than 500,000 people have been displaced since the beginning of the year in Ituri. Just imagine being a child in the chaos of violence and displacement. These children, they have witnessed violence or they have themselves been victim of this violence.
She says some children have been separated from their parents, left vulnerable to sexual violence or being recruited by armed groups. Others have resorted to living in the middle of the forest with nothing to depend on. Frixona says the impact of the violence and displacement in Ituri province on children is immense and long-lasting. She notes that women and children make up more than half of the 1.6 million displaced people in Ituri.
Displaced children are among the most vulnerable. They lack access to basic services and are at great risk of exposure to violence, exploitation, abuse, and trafficking. They are also more exposed to disease and malnutrition. In this context, children can be abducted, threatened, or forced to join armed groups.
Frizona says UNICEF has received reports of 91 children killed, 27 maimed, and 13 victims of sexual violence between January and June this year. She says more than 18 health facilities have been looted or destroyed, and attacks on more than 60 schools have left 45,000 children out of the classroom. She says it is estimated that more than 1 million children were in urgent need of humanitarian assistance in Ituri. UNICEF and its partners have provided more than 87,000 children health care, nutrition, protection, education, water and sanitation services.
We help children previously associated with armed forces reintegrate within the community, and we also help them trace their family and receive psychosocial support. We also provide vulnerable children with safe access to community spaces where they can socialize, play, and learn.
She says, however, the aid is limited because of a lack of funding. UNICEF has appealed for about $390 million for DRC children, but it has received just a quarter of that. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
Residents of a Mombasa slum won a landmark payout in July over pollution by a lead smelter that poisoned residents. Kenya's government was ordered to pay $12 million to residents within 90 days because of its failure to enforce environmental regulations with the smelter, which closed in 2014. But the government has appealed the decision, as Lenny Ruvaga reports from Mombasa, Kenya.
Authorities shut down the lead smelter run by Kenya Metal Refineries EPZ Limited in 2014 due to severe pollution and after several deaths that locals blamed on lead poisoning. But it wasn't until this past July that an environmental and land court awarded the residents of Mombasa's Owino Uhuru slum a $12 million payout. It was the first time the Kenyan government was ordered to compensate victims for failing to stop pollution, setting a precedent for future claims. The celebration, however, was short-lived, as Kenya's Attorney General's office said it was dissatisfied with the decision and planned to appeal. Anastasia Nambu, a resident at the informal settlement, says the appeal has dashed their hopes for an early settlement. She says the government has shown that it does not value the residents of the settlement. People in the community are still suffering as a result, but the government has disregarded all this. Nambu says if the government was concerned about their welfare, they would have settled the claim, but instead they are abusing the court process through their appeal. 48-year-old Nambu, a mother of four, says the pollution gave her constant migraines and body aches, and she can no longer afford her pain medication. Nambu says her entire family has been affected. They were all tested and found to have been poisoned by the emissions from the lead factory. She says her children's memories were affected, leading to poor performance in school, and they also complain of joint aches and migraines every day. Smoke from the smelter discolored rooftops, and a 2015 report by lawmakers said water in the area was contaminated by lead. The court in July also ordered Kenya's National Environmental Management Authority to clean up remaining pollution. But the government's appeal has put that cleanup effort in doubt. Kenya activist group Center for Justice, Governance and Environmental Action helped locals with suing the government. Tom Ooko is the program's officer at CJGEA. He spoke to VOA about the case.
It's been like a decade of suffering for these people. When they continue prolonging this, more people will continue to suffer and more will die. It also means that there is no closure for the families that lost their loved ones, and also there's no health and continuity of safe, sustainable life in this community is at risk.
The Attorney General's office declined to comment on the appeal, and requests for comment from the National Environmental Management Authority went unanswered. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Mombasa, Kenya.
Athletes from Uganda and Ethiopia smashed world athletic records yesterday at the Valencia World Record Day event in Spain. The 24-year-old 10,000-meter world champion Joshua Cheptegei from Uganda topped expectations, running the distance in 26 minutes, 11 seconds. He bested the record set by Ethiopian Kenenisa Bekele in 2005 of 26 minutes, 17.53 seconds. Ethiopia's Lissen Abet Gedei broke the record of the 5,000 meter in 14 minutes, 6.62 seconds. The 22-year-old cut through the previous record of 14 minutes, 11.15 seconds, which her companion Turunesh Dibaba set in 2008. Somalia in September saw the opening of what is being touted as the country's first independent modern arts institution. The Somali Arts Foundation says it seeks to promote creativity and critical discussions on what it means to be a Somali. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Firdousa Hussein is one of the few professional female photographers in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The 25-year-old courage in telling stories through photography is a source of inspiration to women and girls in Somalia. As Firdousa moves around the city looking for stories to capture through her camera lens, she also becomes an attraction to curious onlookers. Firdousa says that when people see her carrying a camera, they say, "Shame on you. This is not the work of a Somali lady. You are tarnishing your reputation." But when she meets with her female friends, they usually say, "Please go ahead. You are doing a great job," since they understand her focus is telling women-related stories. The launch of the Somali Artists Foundation, the first contemporary artists institution in Somalia, offers Firdousa and other artists a much-needed space to show their works. Firdousa says that the launch of the SAF and subsequent exhibition of her pictures was an awesome experience, as it now provides her and others with an opportunity to display their work to a large audience and also highlight female photographers who are doing amazing works of art. Sagal Ali is the founder of the SAF, and for her, it's a lifelong dream come true. Sagal says that she launched this institution to work with every Somali wherever they are, especially those within the country who have the talent. She says that local artists do not have centers like this one to show their talent, like photography. This institution will provide spaces where they can upgrade their talents. Artists say their work has a positive influence on society and can help rebuild Somalia after decades of chaos and war. Salman Madu is a lecturer at Somali National University, specializing in modern arts and photography. Madhu says if he talks about modern arts photography and their storytelling impact, he has to talk about its significance in our country, which is today recovering from decades of conflict, destruction, and civil strife. When you go back through this history, it is photography that exposed the harsh reality of what was happening. As photographer Hussein, she wants to continue to break new ground and inspire more Somali women to follow in her footsteps. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the voice.